From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in the Richmond District, San Francisco.
Ingleside, San Francisco.
I'm from West Portal.
East Oakland.
Coming up, we're looking at solutions to California's water crisis.
One of NASA's top scientists says the state has only about a year's worth of water left.
We'll see how farmers on the Central Coast are finding ways to grow without irrigation.
A lot of people will look at it and go, oh my God, your tomatoes are dying, they have disease or something. Like, nope, they're just transformed into tomato production.
And we'll hear a brief history of how California could have avoided creating a drought state.
Everybody lives in the wrong place. People came here and turned left, going south to where the water is not.
Historical problems and radical solutions to California's water crisis. Today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Earlier this month, Governor Jerry Brown stepped up to a podium in a dry, grassy field in Eastern California. He took a deep breath and made a landmark statement.
We're in an historic drought, and that demands unprecedented action. It's for that reason that I'm issuing an executive order mandating substantial water reduction across our state.
The order forces California's urban areas to use 25% less water. If it happens, that will save the state about 500 million gallons of water. But do you know what would make a much bigger difference? If the restrictions applied to farmers, something the governor did not take on. Agriculture consumes about 80% of California's water. And it makes sense. The state produces the most food in the nation, and farming takes water. But some farmers think it can take less. Our friends at the show Making Contact took on that concept a few years back through the reporting of Joaquin Palomino. And we're going to hear his story now about how a handful of farmers are finding new ways to make every drop count.
These guys, you just like pop that one off. That guy's going to get nice and big.
That's Joe Shermer, walking us through his 20-acre tomato and vegetable farm in Watsonville, California, a small agricultural town on California's central coast.
It's going to be an ocean of green, and then an ocean of red, and then an ocean of decaying, dying tomato plant that just is going to totally dry out, and then back to being soil. We'll cover crop it.
The farm is called Dirty Girl Produce, and at first glance, it doesn't look much different than other farms. There's a tractor in the back of the field, and rows of tomato plants are just starting to break through the dirt. But if you take another look, you might be surprised.
And we're not watering, you know. You don't have to walk over it once a week with big pipe or lay all this plastic tape that then gets into the landfill, you know. I mean, there's so many things that are so satisfying about standing over a field of dry farm tomatoes.
What Joe is doing is called dry farming. People have been doing it for as long as they've been growing food, and it's starting to see a resurgence in California. The tomatoes that Joe grows here use almost no irrigated water, just the rain, carefully stored in the soil through the winter and spring.
And what'll happen with this soil on the surface, this topsoil, it's just going to be bone dry. It's going to be super dry. But you could come out here in September with a shovel and dig down a foot, and you already see moisture. There'll still be moisture down there. Versus if you just let it go, you know, you just had a fallow field and you dug down in September, it would just be bone dry. It'd be super hard, and all the moisture would be gone. So we're just holding that in. And that's
we're on the Central Coast, the home of the redwood, so we see a good amount of rain throughout the winter and spring. And Joe works hard to trap as much of that water as he can into the soil. He does it by covering the ground with mulch to keep the winter rains from evaporating in the dry summer season. He plants his tomatoes as far down as he can, because these plants are going to need to dig their roots deep. Once the summer comes, they might not feel a drop of water for the rest of their lives. So they need to travel far, sometimes 10 feet down, in search of every last drop of water.
These plants are not going to realize that they're dry farmed until, you know, middle to the end of June. In the meantime, they're just going to be spoiled little brats. They're just going to be happy. They have so much compost fertilizer, you know, custom compost blend. And they'll grow up about 4 feet to 5 feet and just look super good. And then all of a sudden, you get a heat wave towards the end of June, beginning of July, and they really start feeling it. You know, that they don't have just an indefinite amount of water that is easily accessible at the surface. And a lot of people will look at it and go, oh my God, your tomatoes, they're dying. They have disease or something. Like, nope, they're just dry farm. That's what they do. They just come up and they all of a sudden transform into tomato production. And they just get loaded with fruit.
This plant gives up on growing pretty leaves and it focuses all of its energy on making fruit. And this fruit is unlike any other tomato you have tasted.
When you dry farm them, they're super juicy and they get real high acid and high sugar and also a real mineral quality because it's really mining the soil, and every drop of water that's coming up is going to be that much more filled with nutrients and not watered down. You know, it has to work harder, so it's bringing up other stuff as it's going.
Growing food without irrigation is common in other parts of the country. All throughout the Midwest, thousands of acres of wheat fields are dry farmed. But here in California, where much of the state is a semi-desert, most farmers use water as if there were an infinite supply.
California is one of the most productive agricultural states in the nation. About 80% of our total developed supply goes to agriculture.
That's Juliet Christian Smith, a senior research associate with the Pacific Institute, a nonprofit working to find a sustainable future for California agriculture.
Because agriculture is so water intensive in California, it will be one of the first sectors to feel the impacts of climate change, and it will be one of the sectors that really has to be a leader in terms of becoming more efficient in water use and setting the path for other industries.
California grows nearly half of all of the fruits, vegetables, and nuts in the country. And California's Central Valley, a long strip right in the middle of the state, grows the bulk of it. But that might not be true for much longer. While weather patterns change from year to year, some drier and some wetter, the long-term prognosis for California's Central Valley is that the climate will get hotter and drier. Climate scientists predict that summer temperatures could exceed 120 degrees, winter rains could diminish, and the rushing spring snowmelt from California's Sierra Mountains could reduce by as much as 90% by 2050. In the face of all of this, many farmers are struggling to hold on to their traditional way of life.
Don't expect big changes to suddenly appear upon the scene when we talk about California agriculture in particular.
Bill Friedland, Professor Emeritus of Community Studies at the University of California at Santa Cruz.
If you study California agriculture, one of the things you learn is the sheer size of the big agribusiness firms. These are enormous corporations. They're not going to go out of business just because times are hard. They're going to try to figure out ways to survive. So we may be moving into a slightly different kind of system where we get continual experimental activity in agriculture around the edges.
You can grow a huge, lush, beautiful crop without any water at all. People have a tendency, growers, people that are learning how to garden and farm, have a tendency to think more is better. So if I add a little bit of water, it's really good, but if I add more water, it's even better.
That was Jim Leap, the head of the University of California at Santa Cruz's Agroecology Center. He teaches hundreds of students dry farming techniques every year.
When I take the students out and show them this dry farm tomato plants, and we're standing there looking at these plants, and they're just some of the biggest, most beautiful plants on the whole farm. And then I say, okay, and now remember that these haven't had any irrigation. It helps them kind of rethink how they might approach irrigation.
A lot of these places that are having, you know, heavy water issues right now, people are like flood irrigating. You know, it's ridiculous.
We are back on Joe Shermer's farm on California's Central Coast.
So the amount of conservation that can be done is immense.
Joe's farm is tiny compared to the big ag businesses of the Central Valley, and he's in a much wetter region. But there's still a lot that the big boys can learn from Joe's technique. And it sets an example that things can be done differently and still be profitable, because somewhere along the way, many of the fields that cover California have separated themselves from nature. A strange notion, because when you think about it, what's more natural than growing food?
That That's reporter Joaquin Palomino. His story originally aired on the nationally syndicated program Making Contact, based in Oakland. Find a link to more of their work at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. Listening to Cross Currents from KALW News, I'm Hannah Baba. Let's go back to that press event Governor Brown held earlier this month.
As Californians, we have to pull together and save water in every way we can.
He spoke near Echo Lake. It's south of Lake Tahoe where the government measures snowpack. This year, when they took the April measurement, there was no snow there at all. That makes it, of course, an historic low. The governor said we could deal with that, except for this.
Look, for over 10,000 years, some people would say for 20,000 years, people lived in California. But the number of those people were never more than 300,000 or 400,000, as far as we know. They lived much simpler. They were able to move when drought occurred.
But now, not so much. California has an estimated 38,800,000 people.
38 million people with 32 million vehicles living at the level of comfort that we all strive to attain.
People mostly live in large metro areas far from sources of fresh water. How did that happen? For that story, we're going to join the American History guys who make the podcast Backstory. They recently made a show called Tapped Out, Thirsting for Fresh Water. And today we'll share with you their story about some of California's water wars.
I'm Brian Ballo, here with Ed Ayers.
That's me.
And Peter Onuf's with us.
Hey, Brian.
Now, if you are one of our listeners in California, you are well aware of the problem that's been plaguing that state for the past few years. It's drought. But to Bill Carl, a historian who writes about water in California, the state's main problem isn't a product of nature, but rather of history.
Everybody lives in the wrong place. People came here and turned left, going south to where the water is not.
Most notably to Los Angeles, which by 1920 had over 500,000 residents. And these residents were thirsty. The city had finished a mammoth aqueduct in 1914 that brought water from the Owens Valley, a lush agricultural region 250 miles to the north. But the aqueduct only got the water that was left after Owens Valley got its fill. And by the early 1920s, it was already obvious that this wasn't going to be nearly enough for L.A. So it was back to the Owens Valley. And this time, the city started a process of buying up land that allowed them to grab water before the farmers in the Owens Valley got it. Those farmers were not amused, and they fought back.
It was that process that metastasized into an armed rebellion. Residents of the Owens Valley who were seeing their livelihood and their life savings being placed at risk began blowing up the aqueduct to Los Angeles, and they blew it up repeatedly.
Los Angeles sent trainloads of armed Pinkerton guards to the valley with shoot-to-kill orders. Owens Valley was not cowed. The resistance hit its peak in 1924.
It happened at the Alabama Gates, a place you can see in lots of cowboy movies. It's beautiful, rugged, western country. The Alabama Gates was where the main gates were for the aqueduct were located, and a large group of the farmers seized control of the gates, and they were shutting off the water supply and allowing the water instead to spill directly onto the valley floor.
Newspapers around the world carried the story. I asked Bill Carl whether this worldwide attention made LA officials consider backing down.
Absolutely and emphatically not. Los Angeles had absolutely no interest in responding to those concerns. This was a battle to the end.
LA couldn't get the authorities in the Owens Valley to do anything. They all sided with the resistance. But the city had an ace up its sleeve. rumors had been swirling about improprieties at Owens Valley banks, and Los Angeles asked state investigators to look into them.
The banks were owned by a family that was very active in supporting the resistance to Los Angeles. And it was discovered that the owners of the banks were, in fact, appropriating funds from the bank in order to fund the ongoing resistance to the city, appropriating funds for terrorist activities is not smiled upon in the banking community. The banks were shut down, the family was ruined, but more importantly, everyone, all of the residents of the valley who had their life savings in the banks lost everything.
The resistance died. L.A. got the land, and in short order, the Owens Valley was dry.
What had been one of the prime agricultural regions of California at the beginning of the 20th century was converted to high desert, scrubland, an area of dust and wind.
Owens Valley and Los Angeles remain tethered in a relationship that Carl says is unprecedented.
The city of Los Angeles winds up owning another community 250 miles away. We don't have in American government any kind of procedures for the management of colonies, but that was essentially what the Owens Valley had become, a colony of Los Angeles.
There is a silver lining to this story. Bill Carl says that in the 9 decades since, it's become kind of a cautionary tale in California. The two major water systems created in subsequent years have built-in protections for the communities where the water comes from. And the state has gotten better about tending to the needs of Californians on both ends of the aqueduct.
Which is not to say that we don't still luxuriate in fighting over water. It is surprising the degree to which people in San Jose, for example, or Oakland, if you read their newspapers, really, really want to make sure that people in Southern California don't have a water supply. The fact of the matter, though, is that if Glendale, a Southern California community, withers and turns into a raisin and everyone has to move away, Oakland is not going to prosper from that. So the question is, have we grown up enough as a society? Do we understand the interrelationships well enough to enable us to work together in the construction of the water system that we need for the next 50 years?
Bill Carl is the author of Water and Power, The Conflict Over Los Angeles Water Supply in the Owens Valley.
For more than 3 years, California has been in a severe drought. As the rainy season draws to a close with the state's snowpack at its second lowest level on record, many are preparing for things to get even worse. State lawmakers this month introduced unprecedented new water use restrictions. Restaurants can't serve water unless the customer asks for it. And farmers in the Sacramento Valley are calculating that they stand to make more money from selling their water than from selling their crops. In Central California, hundreds of thousands of acres of farmland are lying fallow.
And so we thought it would be a good time to replay a show we put together last summer. We looked at how past generations of Americans have struggled over the use of water. The show began with a bit of legal history. As it turns out, those attempts we just heard about by LA to grab as much water as possible have a firm basis in law. But to understand that law, we need to go back east.
Throughout the colonial period, Easterners had relied on streams and rivers to power their mills. But when smaller mill operations started scaling up and building dams of their own, mill owners downstream cried foul. In the 1790s, they started taking their disputes to court, appealing to an old English law principle known as riparian rights. Riparian, stemming from the Latin ripa, for a bank. That principle is essentially that anyone who owns land bordering a body of water has rights to use that water. Now, it might sound straightforward, but legal scholar Dan Tarlock told me that in practice, things quickly got complicated.
Riparian rights is actually a very incoherent theory. everybody who's a riparian has an equal right to use the water in the stream. But the law doesn't go too far beyond that.
Right.
So the mills that faced decreased current began to sue basically the mill that had messed with the stream. But there was so much water in the east that you really didn't get too many serious conflicts over the use of water.
So the east is in fact a very wet place, but the west, as you know, is not. What happened to this law as Americans migrated to the west?
Yeah, well, the gold rush started in 1847 with the discovery of gold at Sutter's Mill. When the miners began to really do serious gold mining, which meant pumping water out of a stream and blasting away hillsides to find the gold.
Wow.
Yeah, so forget the romantic image of the miner standing in a stream with a pan. What the miners were doing, they were first taking it out of the stream and they were transporting it some distance through flumes. And so they were taking it off the land next to the stream.
Right.
And in theory, you can't do that in riparian rights. So when it reached the California courts as early as 1857, they basically said, look, the miners have developed this custom of allowing the first person to use water to obtain a right superior to everyone else. We'll just follow that custom. And that became the origin of the doctrine called the prior appropriation, which is said to be the antithesis of riparian rights.
It can't have been that old a custom since they discovered gold in 49, and by 57, it's a custom.
Right, right. Well, almost all the land in California, and certainly all the land in the other western states, was initially owned by the federal government. Got it from various sovereigns, France, Mexico. And so what should have happened is when the federal government then sold off the land to settlers under the Homestead Act and other laws,
right,
the federal land rights should have carried with them riparian rights. That was the common law. And each state or territory, one of the first things they did was to adopt the common law of England. But as the western states started to develop irrigation, originally it was utopian colonies, Greeley, Colorado, the Mormons in Utah. They were taking water out of the streams. They were taking it out in big quantities. They were transporting it longer and longer distances away from the streams. So the western states picked up the idea of prior appropriation as a customary right, and later courts said, we're adopting it because that's the only system that works in an arid area. And if we don't adopt it, we won't grow.
So basically, there's a different law in the east and the west of the United States?
Right, right. Riparian rights pretty much stop at the Missouri River.
And what's been the long-term consequence of this?
Well, the long-term consequence is that the prior appropriation enabled the western states to move water where it was needed. It enabled them to develop an irrigation economy, which is still in existence, and it enabled them to develop urban centers like Los Angeles, which has almost no natural water supply, or San Francisco as well.
Sounds like a pretty profound consequences. Did people become uncomfortable with that at some point, or does it still seem the only thing that really works in an area like the West?
Well, that's a subject of enormous controversy. Over the last 40 years or so, people have focused more on what was left out in prior appropriation, that is the environment. Fish have suffered.
Huh.
Native Americans were left out, later put back into the picture. And now people are worried that climate change will shrink the overall water budget, and debating whether prior appropriation is the best way to adapt to climate change.
Dan Tarlock is a law professor at the Kitt College of Law in Chicago, and that was a segment from the program Backstory with the American History Guys. It's broadcast here on KALW Mondays at noon, and it's a podcast just like Cross Currents. Sign up at KALW.org. Click on podcasts. You never know what it's like. keep those emails coming at news@kalw.org and find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. Our team includes Audrey Dilling, Chris Hambrick, Angela Johnston, Ted Muldoon, Colin Peden, Liz Mack, Casey Miner, Seth Samuel, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. The managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Allison Faith Levy. The preschool crowd knows her well as Sippy Allison from her days with the kid-pleasing group, the Sippy Cups. Her musical style has been described as power pop meets bubblegum. Allison Faith Levy has a solo show on Thursday at the Noe Valley branch of the San Francisco Public Library. Music starts at 10 o'clock. That's 10 a.m., not p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. The lights go down and the chorus sings. The actors enter from behind.